Major funding for the series is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with support from PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Margaret Cho. This is Crossing East, our stories, our history, our America.
Refugee is a people that someone come over and take over your homeland and you have no place to go. You have to escape for your life.
Being on welfare is probably the most miserable things I've done in my life in America.
I cleaned toilets when I was in high school. I picked berries for all season. Cucumbers, nuts, they were so damn heavy. A big bucket for a buck, but I did it anyway because we need money to pay rent.
Yes, you are free, you are safe now, but you still have a connection to the country that belonged to you, you know, that you lived before. So it was very homesick.
In a moment, Refuge from War on Crossing East.
I'm Dime Roberts with the Crossing East music feature. Cambodian Duran Cravan in Tacoma, Washington, came from a musical family that totaled 11 people. He was immediately drawn to the accordion.
You know, my brother, the oldest one, he play drum, he play violin, flute, and my other brother, he play guitar, drum. Another brother play, younger one play guitar. So we have a band play together with just for fun for the family.
But Duran's family came to an abrupt and tragic end when the Khmer Rouge took over on April 19, 1975. Duran was 21 years old and going to college when the tanks with soldiers rolled into the cities. They rounded up people and took them into the fields and forests to start a new agrarian life. Anyone educated, professional, or capitalist, meaning westernized, was executed. Duran, who was wearing a shirt and tie, was immediately singled out.
They said, "Who's a doctor?" That man, he raised a hand, and professor, raised a hand, soldier, raised a hand, and then they said, "Student," and then I raised my hand.
One of his brothers was with him at the time. Duran appealed to the soldiers to keep them together, but they refused.
Seven soldiers come to escort us to the forest. And that time, we start to know that we must be killed. And so we just walk until the person, I think he's a doctor, he just move his head and then they shoot him.
The men knew they had to do something. Together, they overpowered the soldiers, ran into the Cambodian forest, and tried to survive. They had nothing to hunt with or anything to keep them warm when it rained, and each day they sent Duran, the youngest and most able, to climb the tallest tree to look out for wild animals, or worse, the Khmer Rouge soldiers.
You know, in the forest, there are like a snake, cobra, tiger, elephant, and different kind of wild animal. So that's not easy to live in the forest. But also, you see the beautiful thing in the forest. I can see the birds. I can see the mountain. I can see everything except the faces of my family. So that's why I create that song in my brain that time. I call The Top of the Tree.
One by one, the men died of starvation or were killed by predators or soldiers they encountered. At one point, Duran tried to cross the border to Thailand through the minefields. Duran, to this day, believes the animals came to save his life. A deer ran up in front of him and was blown up, then a rabbit. Rather than risk the minefields, Duran surrendered himself to the Khmer Rouge and was put to work in the camps. He farmed without tools.
You know, even the corn, I have to steal my own corn that I grow, and then they not allow you to do that. So that's why you cannot possess anything. You must be killed if you steal that.
Duran worked in the killing fields through the entire reign of the Khmer Rouge until 1978. He says he wouldn't have survived if something miraculous hadn't happened.
I just saw the accordion on the stem of the tree, and then I said, I want to touch. And then I'm really surprised, and then I say, wow, that's a dream really come true. I just think about that, and then the accordion come. This is the God provide this instrument to me, or what?
The Khmer Rouge let him play. The music drew people from neighboring camps. Children came, and then other musicians. The Khmer Rouge gave them instruments so they could play for festivals that glorified the new regime.
Every kid, all the adult people, they come to see me. That's I become a famous in that time. Famous in the hell time.
And each day after a meager meal of rice, Duran would play his accordion and wonder if any of his family was still alive. He continued to work and starve till January 7, 1979, when the Cambodian leader Pol Pot fled the country to escape a military offensive from Vietnam. Pol Pot also left up to 3 million of his people dead and 4 million starving. The Khmer Rouge soldier just said, "Go home." Duran walked the long road to his family home. All that was left was a gatepost, cement steps, and one younger brother.
When I go there, I just hurt that post and then I cry. I just see the post, but I didn't see my family.
Duran lived under the Vietnamese-installed government in Cambodia till 1984. He then escaped into Thailand, lived in refugee camps for 4 years, and then came to America.
When you say one word, how do you survive? Across everything, I cannot believe. How can I survive? But I'm here. I'm still Duran.
To hear more of Duran Cravan's music, go to crossingeast.org. This Crossing East music feature was made possible by the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Dee Mae Roberts.
I'm Margaret Cho, and this is Crossing East, our stories, our history, our America. We're looking at America as a refuge from war.
Thousands of demonstrators opposed to the Vietnam War assembled in the nation's capital for a mass protest. For the most part orderly, minor scuffles did occur between the demonstrators and hecklers.
Most Americans know the impact of the Vietnam War on America, but know little of the horrors of war that took place in the cities and countryside of Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. We know some escaped and fled their countries to come here as refugees. Yet we do not know that most refugees are still in trauma. They rarely want to talk about their experiences, even to their children. Many of the second generation may have heard mom or dad tell some of their boat stories, but they know very little else except how Southeast Asians are represented in Hollywood's Vietnam-era war movies. Chapter 1, The War Ends for America. In 1975, Southeast Asia was in chaos.
The communist forces overtook the southern part of Vietnam and wanted to replace the political power. As a result, what they did is they imprisoned anyone who was a leader, whether they were a military leader or a political leader in that country, and replaced the form of government so that the socialist form of government was being instituted in this country.
Dr. Linda Trinh Vo, professor of Asian American Studies at the University of California, Irvine.
In the aftermath, in both Laos and Cambodia, communist forces also were fighting for power. And this internal struggle led to a lot of death, a lot of instability, a lot of imprisonment and torture of individuals, and also persecution of minority groups as well. Some of the groups that were persecuted were those in Laos, and they were the Hmong and the Mien groups who had fought alongside the CIA and the U.S. military against the communists. So when communist forces took over in Laos, they persecuted and basically practiced ethnogenocide of those ethnic groups.
Cambodian Duran Cravan lived through the genocide of the Killing Fields when the communist Khmer Rouge took over in 1975. Up to 3 million people were exterminated through forced labor, starvation, or execution. Out of a family of 11, only he and his brother survived.
See this picture? All my family, all of them were killed. When you say one word, how do you survive? Several civil wars and killing field and minefield and refugee camp and here, I'm here. Across everything, I cannot live. How can I survive?
When the American War ended in Vietnam in 1975, thousands of Vietnamese fled to the U.S. These refugees learned to live in a new country, building a vibrant community from coast to coast. But the legacy of warfare
and post-war trauma still haunts them 30 years later. Vietnamese-American writer and journalist Nguyen Quy Duc reflects on the formation of a Vietnamese community in the U.S. and his own ties to his homeland. Chapter 2, Home is Always Somewhere Else, by Nguyen Quy Duc.
My uncle just died. It was cold even inside the funeral home as the monks prayed. A heart attack killed him at 75. He was just 45 when he left Vietnam, coming to America, responsible for a wife, three kids, a stepmother, and me. I was 17 and without my parents, so at the end of the Vietnam War, my uncle took me with him. Saved my life, really. An hour after we cremated him, a blizzard turned Maryland, where he lived, pristine white. It was a strange landscape. I'd left my uncle soon after I came to America and drifted around California. As a kid, I grew up in a time of war. Before I became a teenager, America had already come to my country. Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, or The Doors. That was what I understood America to be. But the music came with men in army fatigues. Hundreds of them tore throughout town in central Vietnam, their trucks noisy, dusty, their rifles a scary sight. The year I turned 10, things really changed. Tet, the Lunar New Year, had arrived. But the sound of firecrackers celebrating the Year of the Monkey in 1968 was replaced by gunfire and explosions. North Vietnamese troops invaded several cities in the south. In the city of Hue, where our family was on holiday, thousands died in a month of house-to-house fighting. Thousands disappeared, among them my father. It would be 16 years before I saw him again. I carried on with school, but for years, my father's absence loomed over us, and the war grew worse. When the war ended in 1975, an estimated 3 million Vietnamese had died. America was mourning the 58,000 it had lost, and would come to relive the nightmare of defeat for years. Vietnam plunged into extreme poverty.
Welcome to America, and welcome to Camp Pendleton. At this time, I need each of you to move to the Quonset huts that you were assigned to.
About 100,000 Vietnamese ended up as refugees in America, including my uncle, his family, and myself. The churches, charities, and families that sponsored us did all they could to welcome us and create physical comfort. What they couldn't give us was a sense of home. At 17, I was riding the bus to school and always feeling the gaze of others. It was as if they could see the shame of defeat on my back and the guilt of having left my parents and a sister behind. For the first couple of years, we had no news of home, but we eventually learned to live without pain. People I knew were getting married, building new families, new identities. At some point, we began to accept that we were Asian Americans. Time passes, we spoke more and more English, and then came time to apply for American citizenship. A sensible thing to do, but we did it with a measure of shame. Being American seemed a betrayal of our roots, our nation, our real selves.
Kính chào quý khán giả. Đây là chương trình 30 phút thông tin văn hóa và nghệ thuật Việt Nam do Tổ chức Việt Nam Truyền thông chủ trương và thực hiện. Chương trình này được phát thanh mỗi trưa Chủ nhật từ 1 giờ đến 1 giờ 30 trên băng tần KUSF 90.3 FM.
I ended up in Northern California with a radio show for the Vietnamese that had formed a community here. We were settling down roots in our little Saigons, replenished by the arrival of boat people, those who risked their lives escaping from communism
Tình khúc cho em của Lê Nguyên Phương.
Watch one of their popular entertainment videos now. You would know these are people who'd been in labor camps, who'd lived in near hunger in the 80s, and who'd escaped on boats across the Pacific. It's estimated that between a third to half of those who left this way died at sea. After 12 years in prison camps, my dad was sent home, and 4 years later came to America with my mom. My sister had died. She too was cremated, her ashes placed in an urn and left with monks in Saigon, now renamed Ho Chi Minh City. My parents settled in San Francisco. We learned to be a family again. They never thought of going back to Vietnam. I was desperate to. They were afraid of all sorts of danger. Prison and the years of communism had done terminal damage. I went back to Vietnam nearly 15 years after coming to America. No American dream could hold me back. Home was home, and I pined for it. I found former classmates and the old home, but the country had changed, and I had changed. In a temple in Ho Chi Minh City, I cried and cried. I'd found my sister's ashes. I sat with the monks for a while, and then I brought her ashes to the United States. The family was whole again. The Vietnamese in America still carry some wounds, but there's a generation born here that's graduated from college. In corporate boardrooms, on TV, and in government offices, there are Vietnamese faces. In their homes, they've set up altars with pictures of the ancestors, remembrance of the dead and the past. I can't stay away from Vietnam. Since leaving, I've been back 20 times, sliding back into the old culture, like a jewel thief into his favorite velvet gloves. 30 years ago, I followed an uncle and crossed the Pacific. The ocean separated us from our birthplace. Millions of Vietnamese have died. Millions have survived. Some in one country, some in another. And some of us cross back and forth. A month before he passed away, my uncle visited Vietnam for the first time in 30 years. The family thinks the long trip, the dire conditions, and the terrible shape of his childhood home finally did him in. My aunt thinks of bringing his ashes home in a few years. Maybe he's there already, in the way that we Vietnamese think of how souls can travel to a birthplace. I fly back and forth, the ocean beneath the wings of the airplane, beneath the clouds. I'll visit my uncle's ashes wherever. The ocean doesn't separate, it connects my two homes.
Home is always somewhere else, by Nguyen Quy Duc. He's host of KQED's Pacific Time, distributed by Public Radio International, with help by Peter Breslow, Arthur Laurent, and Nina Thorson. When we return, we look at how refugees adjust to an American life. This is Crossing East. I'm Margaret Cho.
This is PRI, Public Radio International.
Thank you.
I'm Margaret Cho, and we're looking at a refuge from war on Crossing East. Chapter 3, What is a Refugee? Dr. Linda Trinh Vo.
A refugee is similar to someone who is an immigrant. However, a refugee is someone who is fleeing their own country because of fear of persecution, whether that be political persecution, religious persecution, or ethnic persecution.
The refugees who came to America were Vietnamese, Cambodian, Laotian, and the ethnic minorities from Laos, the Mien and Hmong. Most had fought on the same side and helped the U.S. military in the war in Vietnam. The Mien and Hmong, the rural people in Laos, were particularly vulnerable for helping the CIA with covert operations. Staying in Laos was not an option. By 1979, there were almost 62,000 Vietnamese in refugee camps. More than 140,000 people displaced from Cambodia and Laos joined them.
They were dispersed all across the country. There was lingering animosity. People were unsure of who, you know, these refugees were, why they were here. So the U.S. government wanted to process them as quickly as possible and also get them to assimilate as quickly as possible.
Oregon and Washington State had the fifth largest population of Southeast Asian refugees in the country. The Portland School District was one of the first to figure out how to work with Southeast Asian youth coming to their schools. The 1.5 generation, those who came to this country at a young age, learned quickly, mastering language and writing skills before their first generation parents. Now they own businesses and work as professionals and community leaders in Portland. Chapter 4. Refugee Dreams Revisited by Anne Morin and D. May Roberts.
Every Sunday afternoon, about 500 kids come to the Van Long Vietnamese School in Southeast Portland. Parents started the school in 1990 because they didn't want their kids to forget what it means to be Vietnamese. The students range in age from kindergarten to high school.
Miền Bắc có nhiều bao nhiêu hệ thống sông nguồn kể ra.
Quy Nguyen and her husband Tien, along with 50 teachers and volunteers, work every Sunday for free.
It's not only for them to know the language, but it's help for the family, for the connection with parents and grandparents. And because by the time my son grow up, and if he doesn't know how to speak Vietnamese, then he lose his root. And that is a big, big problem for the family.
Quy came to Portland after the fall of Saigon when her husband Tien was sent to a re-education camp to do hard labor. He told her to escape Vietnam with their four-year-old daughter, Christine. Quy became one of the hundreds of thousands of people fleeing Vietnam on overcrowded boats in dangerous seas filled with pirates.
We were surrounded by the 10 pirate boats, and all the women had to climb down the trunk, hide in there, and because we know that if the pirates see us, they're gonna kill or they're gonna do bad things.
One of the refugee men shot off a flare gun to scare the pirates, and it worked. The pirates decided not to board and drifted away.
The third night, it was a storm, a very big storm. Christine said, Mom, look at, and I look at, I saw all lights, you know, all lights there. And I said, oh my goodness, we reached some cities. We were so happy.
Like thousands of other Southeast Asians, Quy and her daughter spent 4 months in a refugee camp before coming to Portland. Li Cheng Teng was a child when the Khmer Rouge communists drove into her town. They made everyone go to the countryside to do forced labor in what would be known as the killing fields.
Finally, they said everybody have to go, but only just for a few days. You don't even have to lock your doors. People, they don't take anything with them. All they take is money and material things. You know, they would drive their car. They thought that they'd be back in a few days, but they never returned.
Instead of following the Khmer Rouge, Li Cheng's mother fled with her family to Thailand, where the border was lined with minefields.
And so like about 300-400 people would walk across the border to a Thai village. And in certain areas, very dangerous, they have all kinds of bandits. And also the Khmer Rouge, they still hide in that forest. And sometimes they would come and rob people and sometimes even kill or rape young girls. In that area, you have to be very quiet and walk very fast. And if you could run.
They made it, after several months of hardship and starvation, to a refugee camp run by the Red Cross. Somewhere between 1.7 to 3 million people died in the killing fields of Cambodia.
Safety is the reason when we became refugees, because we were told when the communists came, they would butcher everyone. They will kill everyone, especially the kids.
Refugee is the people that someone come over and take over your homeland and you have no place to go. You have to escape for your life.
Many refugees like Long San Seo and Pham Nhung Lee, both Mien, left Laos with nothing but the clothes on their back.
If your house is on fire, are you going to stay inside a house or get out of your house? My house was on fire. That's why I have to run.
You know, you have to go somewhere that is safe for you to be able to survive and safe for your life and your family. You have no house. You have nothing anymore.
The camps in Thailand could barely provide the necessities of survival for the thousands fleeing from Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos.
The first refugee camp, we stayed there for about 8 months. And more people were escaping from Laos. In the camp, there were so many things that we were suffering. A lot of people got sick. Many people died from diarrhea, from illnesses. If you do not follow the rules, you can put in jail.
But refugees continued to arrive in the camps throughout the 80s and 90s. Lee Po Cha's family walked for almost a month through deep jungle from Laos to the Mekong River, along with thousands of other Hmong.
You know, the refugee camps are not something that many of us could imagine. We don't have much freedoms. You know, 18,000 people live in this little tiny camp, you know, just bamboo tent, you know, your little space. And families after families, they just crawl into this little space.
Because the U.S. involvement in Southeast Asia left vast numbers of people homeless, America responded with the Refugee Act of 1980. It formally defined a refugee as anyone fleeing their country because of persecution or fear of persecution based on race, religion, nationality, social group, or political opinion. The Act created a formal resettlement plan for refugees and set a ceiling on the numbers that could be admitted in the U.S. Church and community groups around the country, like Lutheran Family Services and Catholic Charities in Portland, worked tirelessly to sponsor and place families. Cantalee Tamavong remembers being puzzled at her first view of America when she arrived from Laos with her husband and two children.
We didn't see much about what we see in this kind of, you know, high-scaping buildings. Try to look down, I was sitting by the window, try to see how it's like, where is it? And I didn't see it except just this greens. And I say, where are we going?
Long San Seo had the same reaction when he arrived in winter.
In the airplane, I think about 8 o'clock in the morning. When we first came, you know, December was very, very cold. It was raining and cold. I asked them, how can we go to work? They told me that people work inside. That was the best feeling I got, because in this cold weather, I have to work outside, I may die.
Long San found indoor work as a school janitor. With no language skills, it was a blessing to have any kind of job while learning to live in a new country. Americans in general were ignorant of the struggles of Southeast Asian refugees and clung to old racist stereotypes. When he first arrived, Sokum Touch had to explain he was Cambodian.
At that time, people did not know where Cambodia is and who is Cambodian. They always telling me that go back to Japan, because that's all they know. At that time, people not that much friendly, and they keep looking you like a stranger because you look different, you speak different, you didn't even speak the language at that time.
And Lee Po Cha had to explain that he was Hmong from Laos.
I believe that during those days, we do have some racism going on, and we do had some difficulty. We had a lot of fight between, you know, Asian kids and our Caucasian, so African-American kids there. You know, we've been calling names. We've been shot at.
Cambodian Ki Long Ung had survived the killing fields and refugee camps. Attending high school in Portland in 1980 was another brutal experience, this time with racism and poverty.
At school, there's always boxes of old clothes that people donated, and I actually had some of those to wear. Being on welfare is probably the most miserable things I've done in my life in America. It was embarrassing. I went to school, kids were laughing at me. With limited English, I understood that language. The language of love and the language of hate. Doesn't matter how you speak it, doesn't matter how you listen to it, you can actually understand that.
Kee Long Ong runs his own consulting firm and is president of the Cambodian American Community of Oregon. He says learning English was often the biggest hurdle to making a new life in America.
English is probably one of the most illogical languages to learn, and I absolutely hated speaking English until now.
Most adults were slower to learn than their children. Pharmyun Lee, a Mien from Laos, remembers her first English language classes.
When I get here, I don't know any English at all. So when I go to anywhere, when people talk, I cannot pick up any words. What I heard is there's no word broken. Just go, you know, that's all. So I have no idea. I mean, it's not easy, you know, it's hard. They're teaching us just like a kindergarten kid.
Cambodians Lee Cheng Tang and Sokum Touch were glad to have any job because it helped their families.
I cleaned toilets. When I was in high school, I picked berries for all season. Cucumbers, nuts, they were so damn heavy. A big bucket for a buck, but I did it anyway because we need money to pay rent. But we're happy that we had freedom. This is our choice that we make, and we get our money. That's our money. We can spend on anything we want.
Our job, like my job, was before a strawberry picker, and none of the mainstream want to do that. A whole day, you earn $10. At that time, they felt that we come here to steal their job. You know, we come here to steal everything that they have. It's just a misunderstanding from the mainstream community that we are here to steal things from them.
Many refugees are very reluctant from the beginning to accept entry-level wage jobs.
Long San Seo adjusted so quickly to life in America, he was able to help many of the Mien from Laos to start over. He offered them a philosophical view of the path to success.
I mean, back their homeland. There could be military commanders, officials, or government officials, or school teachers, or they have high-ranking positions. But entry-level job is the way, if they get a chance, they should start. And many of them made it to the top in a few years.
The myth that Asians are the model minority, well-to-do and well-educated with higher incomes, is not true for many Southeast Asians. Many refugees struggle to stay above the poverty line. The 70s and 80s was a tough time to immigrate to Oregon. The timber industry was going bust and unemployment was at an all-time high in the state. Hmong were members of the underclass then. Lee Po Cha says they've now moved up to the ranks of the working class.
During those days, a lot of Hmong families are struggling. But today, I think they're all employed, you know, they have their own homes, and I would say that we may not, you know, living the American dreams yet, but, you know, we are becoming self-sufficient ourselves.
Lee Po Cha is now the director of the Asian Family Center in Portland. He works directly with Asian youth. Nationally, 1 in 7 Asian American children live in poverty, a factor in the rise of Asian gang activity.
What really motivated kids to join gangs, it varies so much. Poverty is one. Being discriminated against may also be one of the reasons.
At first, most of the Mien parents do not accept that the kid will involve in the gang.
Long San Seo is president of the U Mien community of Oregon.
Because the parents did not understand English, and the kids come home, parents can't communicate with them. Parents don't know until the school informed them. And then they began to realize the kids were in trouble, and by then it's too late.
Since she arrived in Portland as a refugee, teacher Kim Nguyen has dedicated her life to working with troubled kids in juvenile detention facilities.
They think that they discriminated against, so they join the gangs to get the protection that they need and to be someone. If you belong to a gang, it means something, and you can show to the world that you are somebody else.
And Kim Nguyen says it isn't just the kids. The problems run deeper at home.
So we have parents who work couple jobs. We have parents who are divorced. We have domestic violence. We have child abuse. And then the sad part for these families is that they are not familiar with the language or how to navigate the system and how to get help. And then especially when parents whose children got into the legal system, then it's even scarier.
Southeast Asian refugees fled for their lives after the Vietnam War. America offered a new place to start over, but provided no escape from the post-war trauma.
Li Cheng-Tang works in her family's grocery store in Portland, but the memories of being a refugee are still with her.
I see all the time on TV. I would see food been tossing, tons of food been tossing. I would imagine, God, and once upon a time, I would just do anything just to have a bite of that food. Okay, that's a flashback. And also, when I see a sad scene on TV or go to a movie where people feel so hungry, I was there. I know exactly how it felt, you know, to be hungry.
Quy Nguyen and Cantali Tamavong long for their homeland.
Yes, you are free, you are safe now, but you still have a connection to the country that belonged to you, you know, that you lived before. So it was very homesick. I miss my parents, my sisters still left there, and every night I dream about I went back to Vietnam. You're homesick, but you're still afraid of the government, you're still afraid of being there, you know.
When we came, we didn't seem to worry about that, you know, we miss the homeland. But when we're getting older, I don't know, that kind of feeling is coming back to you that you long to want to go see your own country. Seems like you want to go back and you'll be able to go travel and see other friends and family that who you love in other state too, because when we leave home, we don't know who's where.
Some, like Long San Seo, actively help out in their original countries.
Me and my wife, we plan to work until our retired age. One of my goals is to go back to Asia, to Laos or China or Thailand to educate those people. We have so many good things for other countries to learn. Through my years of experience here, that you can take back to your homeland, and I think those people will really appreciate. Yes, I hope our dream will come true one day.
Cambodian Sokum Touch is now the director of the nonprofit Immigrant and Refugee Community Organization. He says many refugees fulfill a cultural responsibility for family here and overseas.
I took my children over there for them to see. This is where I came from. This is the school that I went to. And if you are older brother, you're supposed to take care of the rest of the sibling. We have a parent, some of us build a house for the parent. The relationship is still very strong in terms of relationship in Cambodian community.
And they maintain tight communities in Portland. Pham Yun Lee says because the Mien are small in numbers, they support one another like a large extended family.
We don't have that many people, but we're all really close. We're helping each other. Like someone's losing family member, we all, the whole community come by and they all pitch in the money to give the donation to this family to help them with the funeral expense and all that, you know, they buy them food. So how to help our community to stay strong? Today, I am worried about the younger generation now. They have too many things to learn about American culture, and I'm afraid that in the future, maybe the children doesn't know where they come from and what their ancestors are and a background they're coming from. And not to forget about that. It's important for them to carry that on.
Carrying on traditions and preserving culture, giving back to their children and to their communities is the refugee dream for Southeast Asians in Portland. Ki Long Ong.
The fact that I was able to get through the Khmer Rouge and I was able to overcome the language barrier and the culture barriers and get to where I am today, a lot of times I look back, I look in the mirror, it's like, how did I get here?
Refugee Dreams Revisited by Anne Morin and D. May Roberts. You can find a flash movie about this piece on our website at crossingeast.org. In a moment, the contributions of Southeast Asian refugees in America. I'm Margaret Cho, and this is Crossing East.
You're listening to PRI, Public Radio International.
Thank you.
I'm Margaret Cho, and this is Crossing East. Chapter 5, An American Life. One never forgets the ravages of war. The mental and physical trauma remains. It has a lifetime impact on refugee families. Many live in poverty in Southeast Asian communities across the country. Duran Kirvan works as a social worker in Tacoma, Washington. He has helped many fellow Cambodians living in poverty and isolation. Every year, Duran organizes a massive water festival celebration to bring awareness to and unify the Cambodian community in Washington State. That's how he gives back to the community.
We want to preserve the culture. We want to share the unity among the Asian and American people. And we want to be a part of the community, especially in the USA. We want to inspire for next generation. We want to let the people come together to make the community strong and to let the people in love each other. We create peace and love together. We not create a war. I don't want to see anybody have a stereotype to, you know, try to fight, because I still believe that one flower doesn't make a garden until you have too many flowers, different color, put together one place, and you can call a beautiful garden.
In Little Saigon, in Westminster, outside of Los Angeles, thousands of Vietnamese Americans attend a New Year's Tet festival. Little Saigon is what Linda Trinh Vo calls an ethnic enclave. It's a safe way to network and create community.
An ethnic enclave allows groups to assimilate because it allows them to share information with one another. It can help them in terms of finding a job, finding housing. It allows the first generation to really survive and to readjust.
Dr. Vo says these enclaves have also helped to revitalize neighborhoods in decline.
They've changed the American landscape with their ethnic communities. Whether they're residential areas or commercial or cultural spaces, they pay millions of dollars in taxes to the community and also have revitalized areas that were dwindling previously and just have added significantly to the vitality of cities and towns where they're located. You can see them going into all kinds of occupations, making political contributions, participating in the electoral process, participating in the local economy, becoming professionals.
And for those refugees able to successfully seize the American dream, they've made it their mission to give back to their communities. The capital of Hmong America is St. Paul, Minnesota, where a bustling market covers more than a city block, crowded with shoppers. Nearly 200,000 Hmong live in America. Some have just arrived from camps in Thailand. They are the last Hmong refugees allowed into the U.S. Others have lived here for almost 30 years. In Laos, the Hmong were peasant farmers. During the Vietnam War, the Central Intelligence Agency recruited the Hmong to gather intelligence in the borderland between Vietnam and Laos. At the height of the war, there were 30,000 Hmong soldiers. They suffered horrific losses and helped to save many American lives. After the communist takeover of Laos, the Hmong fled to refugee camps in Thailand. Nearly a third of the Hmong population in Laos eventually migrated to the United States. Our final chapter of Refuge from War, Hmong in America, by Mary Stuckey.
I'm Ai Mo, and I came here when I was 6. When your family find out that you're sad or you're sick, they usually do this to call back the spirit. In a bowl, there's a chicken and an egg. She has bells, they're metal, and she shakes it back and forth to make sounds.
My name is Mi Moa. I'm a state senator. I represent the east side of the city of St. Paul. I was born in Laos, and in 1978, my family came to the United States as refugees. Traditional Hmong Americans believe that everything has a spirit or a soul. Now there are a lot of Hmong American entrepreneurs to accommodate in a very appropriate manner the cultural practices that continue to persist and perpetuate in the community.
And this is the story cloth right here. Instead of painting a picture, they sew a picture of their life onto a cloth. This scene shows the Hmong people growing rice and vegetables. They also grow opium for cash crop to China. And then the war in Vietnam came to the peaceful Hmong village.
There's a plane dropping bombs and the house is on fire. So the family packed their stuff up the hills to the jungle. And they cook in the jungle, they eat over there, they run away from the Vietnamese or from the soldiers that's chasing them.
I'm Dia Cha, and I'm a professor at St. Cloud State University. I was born in the early 1960s and grew up during the secret war in Laos. And my father was recruited by the American CIA. He was a soldier for many years, and he was missing in action in 1972. And he never came back, so we don't know what happened to him. You know, when I was little and girl, my grandmother always tell me this story about this white man with curly hair who come into her village, and his plane was shot down. And so he have another friend with him who died. And so it was the Hmong man who go and rescue this white man and brought to the village, but because language barrier, they cannot communicate with each other, and this man was so depressed and so sad, and she took him into the house, and you know, he got cuts over his face, and so she put some herbal medicine on his wound, and then, you know, trying to feed him. And usually the Hmong way is that when you have someone who's injured, someone sick, you prepare a special meal for them. You boil rice, and they're very soft and tender, and you feed them with that. And so she does that for him. And then after he feels better, then they took him to the district and sent him away.
I'm Ai Mo, and I'm translating for my mother-in-law, Hua Tao. My mother-in-law hid in the jungle for about 7 years with her family after the war. And they were hiding because of the communists trying to catch them. All they could bring mostly is blankets, mostly rice, and pots and pans and a knife so they could eat and find food. While in the jungle, 3 of her younger kids that were born in the jungle passed away. So when they crossed the Mekong River, there's only 7 kids. At midnight, they would steal little boats, and all the family would sit in there while their husbands sail the boat to the other side. When they first came in, it was cold. Snow is everywhere. And they don't know anything, so they just stayed home, watched the traffic light going red, green, and orange. They didn't really want to stay, but they had to.
I'm Peng Yang. When I came here, I was only 11 years old, and I am a Hua Tao son, and I'm married to Ai Mo, and I have a 5 kids, two girls, 3 boys. And me and I, we married when I was 19, and she's only 17. Part of my culture is mostly a family. They have a big family, at least like a 10 or more. When I got here, it's not that tough. I learned a little bit in English in Thailand. I know like I want to go to America. This is cheer book, that kind of stuff. But when I go to school, the first day in go to school, was kind of scary. The first year, a little bit struggle, but second year, I'm okay.
There are pockets of communities all across the state where there are Hmong Americans who are extremely successful. Within the community, we have a concern. It feels to us like there's a large number of Hmong Americans who continue to live in poverty. Many have never had an education, and I'm concerned about that because it's got implications for things like, you know, opportunities for violence in the home. It gives the poverty gives rise to exploitations of other sorts like gang activities, domestic violence, depression, untreated mental health issues.
Some of the children who were born in this country, especially in the 90s, a lot of children joined gang and who were just totally lost, don't know who they are, whether they are considered themselves Americans or Hmong, and again, because, you know, in the home, they were taught that they were Hmong, but then in the school, there's nothing that teach them about Hmong. And so because of the parents so busy trying to survive in this society that they may not have the same amount of time to spend with the children. So we have some of those things that we, some of the challenge that we face.
I am so hopeful about this new wave of Hmong American refugees who are just arriving. I feel like they are so lucky to be arriving at a time when the Hmong American community is so able to give them the support that they need. There were actually two formal refugee camps established in Thailand for Hmong refugees from Laos. And I believe in the early 1990s, those two camps formally closed down. It wasn't because they were empty. And there were some attempts to repatriate the remaining individuals in the camps back to Laos. But many people were worried about persecution and what was going to happen to them. And so some people left the two formal camps when they heard that it was being shut down. They sought refuge at this temple that was being run by an abbot who cared very much about refugees. And this temple then becomes sort of a default refugee camp. So the United States government decided that they would go through a formal process and accept, you know, 15,000 to be resettled in the United States.
I'm Aimoa, and I'm translating for my sister-in-law, Blia Yang, and she's been separated from her family for about 20 years in the camps. Blia stayed behind because she was left with her husband, because his family didn't want to come yet.
She didn't get to see them when they leave, but she heard that they're leaving, and she was crying because she's left behind.
In Blia's family, Blia have like two kids, one son, one girl, and her husband only. She cannot afford it for rent a house. That's why she ended up to stay with me. Yes, I'm taking care of her and the whole family. For, you know, for the food, for transportation. You know, that part of the culture, you have to take care of your family. It doesn't matter how struggle it is. That's the first thing that's important to your life. So, to help each other. Families, yes, even more important than the money.
Yeah, the microwave. She still don't know how to press, like, you know, how, you know, many minutes yet, but she just puts it in, and when she knows that she needs to take it out, she just takes it out. We showed her how to use the stove, microwave, you know, turn the hot water and cold. So.
Blia. Blia, what are you doing this weekend?
At home, huh, teacher?
At home. My name is Kate Miller, and I am a teacher for the functional work English classes. We have 14 students now in the class, and this is a high beginning to intermediate group, and many are studying for their driver's license, and many are looking for housing, so that's kind of what we focus on here.
Leah, do you take care of children at home?
Yeah.
Do you like to cook?
Yes. I don't know say a teacher.
That's okay. Do you like to cook chicken?
Only one. Chicken, rice, bell pepper.
Bell pepper.
I often think about my mother-in-law when I talk to senior groups. My mother-in-law, when she goes to bed at night and she dreams, she doesn't dream about getting to, you know, my husband's car and driving to Rainbow and buying groceries. She dreams about strapping on a basket, walking down a dirt path to her garden, where she sees family members or other people who have passed away, or she reunites with them. Oftentimes, when they go to sleep, their sleep reality is not in this country, because in a way, their souls and in their minds, psychologically, they're still living the life back in Laos.
She didn't want to talk about her life anymore because she's upset that she lost her husband and without the memories that she had with them from running from Laos to jungle to Thailand, and that gives her a lot of memories of him.
What I know, even like everybody, they say America one of the best places ever to be settled. You have freedom. Freedom of religion, freedom of culture, everything. Freedom of speech. You know, in the jungle, you know, what do you want to be in the jungle? In here, each person had their own blanket. In the jungle, you had like a whole family just share only one blanket. I never missed home at all. Here's my home. That's what I thought.
Hmong in America by Mary Stuckey. You heard the voices of Hua Tao, Ai Mua, Leah Yang, Peng Yang, scholar Dia Cha, Kate Miller, and Senator Mi Mua. We came in many waves. We fled wars and starvation. We gave our children better lives. We revitalized neighborhoods and gave back to this country. This is Crossing East, our stories, our history, our America. I'm Margaret Cho.
Crossing East is produced with major funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Paul G. Allen Family Foundation, the Spirit Mountain Community Fund, the Regional Arts and Culture Council, and the Oregon Arts Commission, and individual donors of Media Rights Productions. Music on the show was performed by Duron Cravon from his CD, Music Through the Dark. Helicopter sounds were provided by the film Saigon, USA. Our lead scholar is Judy Young, Professor Emeritus of American Studies at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Our managing editor is Catherine Stifter. Associate producer is Sarah Caswell Colbert. The Crossing East engineer is Clark Salisbury, with technical assistance by Michael Johnson and marketing and outreach by Ping Ka. The executive producer is D. May Roberts. To find out more about Crossing East, go to crossingeast.org. Support for Crossing East comes from this station and Public Radio International stations, and is made possible in part by the PRI Series Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.